Welcome once again to another edition of Culture Shock's Shockwave, our weekly podcast and blog and extension here that we do every week. And we have the great honor and pleasure of talking to one of the founding members of one of reggae's great labels, especially based here in the U.S., Mr. Michael Goldwasser. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Lance.
Yeah, and like I said before, let's, you know, want to thank you for what you do. And, you know, I did a little background and I found out some things I didn't know, which is always nice. And these interviews, you always learn some things that you didn't know before. And that's part of the process. And part of the idea is to unravel information that we don't know. And Michael, let's just start. I like to start from the beginning and bring it up to time. So Tell us about where you grew up, where you're born, where you grew up, and your upbringing, and wherever that was.
Yeah, sure. Well, I was actually born in the great state of West Virginia, which is kind of funny since I moved to New York when I was a kid, and I'm such a New Yorker, but I was actually born in West Virginia, which a lot of people find interesting. And my parents brought me up with a lot of music. All the time, like from the time I was a baby, I was listening to whatever they were listening to, jazz, classical, R&B, Latin music, all kinds of music. And that continued all through growing up. So I was always exposed to different kinds of music. But one of the great things about growing up in New York was my exposure to reggae and other Caribbean music. I remember hearing reggae for the first time on the radio. I was with my dad in the car. I don't know what station we were listening to, but there are a lot of stations in New York that at least used to play reggae. And I remember, I really distinctly remember, I don't remember the song. I remember it was a woman singing. It might've been, you know, Marcia or Rita Marley or something. But I remember asking my dad, what is this music? You know, and he said, yeah, it's reggae. And I think I was maybe 8 years old. And then growing up in New York City, I went to school with a very diverse population, culturally, ethnically, and I was exposed to more reggae, and I started playing music. I started playing guitar, and something about reggae just really made a lot of sense to me. Musically, it hit me right in my heart, and lyrically, I was a socially active kid because of my parents, and I was drawn to the themes of fighting against injustice, fighting for equal rights, decrying the problems in the world, you know, making a focus on people whose voice needed to be heard. And that meant a lot to me. And then also I'm Jewish, and I recognized at a young age that a lot of the lyrics in reggae and the themes and the iconography are based in Jewish scripture and iconography because of I didn't know it then when I was younger, but the strong tie between Judaism and Rastafari, and that when the founders of Rastafari in 1930s in Jamaica, they were coming out of the church in Jamaica that was very rooted in Jewish scripture, and the stories of the Exodus from Egypt and redemption from slavery and a return to Zion, all these things that are very crucial to reggae, which are also crucial to Judaism. And I would hear songs, like I'd hear a Bob Marley song, and I'd realize that the lyrics were taken from a psalm that maybe I knew in Hebrew. So we're all connected as people. I mean, that's part of the great things about being a human, right? Is we all have these, you know, people always looking for differences, but it's much more satisfying to look for connections, you know? So anyway, I recognize these connections, and it just set me on the path towards embracing reggae. And maybe that's a more long-winded answer than you expected, but that's my early years with reggae.
No, that's, you know, no, that's perfect. You actually answered several questions all in one. So it worked out well. And, you know, a lot of the same things that you experienced and went through, and the things that you saw and liked about reggae, and the the icons and the scriptures and everything, were very similar to me. In my experience with reggae too, I first heard reggae when I was about 11. How old were you when you first heard it on the radio?
I think I was 8 years old. That's my memory. Yeah.
I mean, you know, and I had the same feeling. I was just taken back. Like, what is this music? Oh my God. I was just so enthralled. So it's nice to hear a similar story. But I come to understand. So how did your involvement, how did you get involved in music?
Sure.
From there, once you got into, I mean, obviously we had the same kind of upbringing, lots of music being played, and I always had music I loved. So that's another similarity. But what was the transition from loving music to getting involved or playing music?
Yeah, sure. Well, when I was, maybe 13, I started learning guitar. I was always a musical kid, but I didn't really, play an instrument, but I started learning guitar. With some friends, we would play Beatles songs. And then I got into, I had this cassette of Catch a Fire by the Wailers. And on both sides of the cassette, it was the entire album. So it's just, you could just like let it go over and over again and keep hearing it. So I like pick along to that. And my band in high school, we started playing clubs and bars around New York City, even though we were legally like too young to legally be in these places. But things were a little more lax back in the 80s. So, and we played all kinds of music, including reggae. We played reggae, ska, funk, R&B, rock. We were just influenced by all the music we loved, you know, because when you're young, you don't realize that society wants to pigeonhole you and make you just, oh, you do this, you do that. You know, so we were naive and we made lots of different kinds of music. And it was great playing in all these places in New York. I played the famous club CBGB many, many times. And that was a thrill. Lots of different interesting places around New York. And then when I was in college, my high school band broke up because people went their separate ways. But in college, I had another band and we kept playing all over New York, and even had some gigs opening for some pretty big bands. And we were playing reggae and R&B. Those were like our two loves. And at some point, so we had a manager and he's like, look, you've got to choose, you know, and maybe we didn't have to choose, but we thought we were young. We thought we had to choose. So we decided to put reggae to the side and just be an R&B band, which was still great. I love R&B music. And we had a lot of great opportunities. A lot of great things happened for us. But eventually I still was always, loving reggae, playing reggae. I didn't just play guitar. I also played bass. Now I also play keys. But back then I was mostly playing guitar and bass. And as all you reggae fans know, bass is the most important instrument and a great instrument to play for reggae. So then my band broke up. And then that led to the creation of Easy Star Records. I don't know if you want to discuss anything else before I go into that, but.
Yeah, no, that's exactly where I'm going. You're right on path with everything, but I do want to back up a little bit.
Sure.
Because the band you chose when you were in college, you chose to do R&B. Now, I still feel like R&B is still a significant part of your life. And it is, tell us a little bit more about that and then we'll jump into Easy Star. And does Easy Star release any of that R&B stuff as well?
Right. Well, so yeah, I love all music. I mean, I love good music, music that I hear that I love. I don't care what genre it is, but I do tend to, gravitate towards reggae, towards R&B, towards jazz, towards Afrobeat and other West African music. These are just things that somehow reach me more. And especially, like I said before, growing up in New York, exposed to all this stuff, but also New York was a center of really great R&B music. Where I lived in Queens, had a lot of amazing R&B and jazz musicians living there. So yes, I've always, even though I've been very much concentrating on Easy Star and reggae for the last 25 years, I always kept up with my interest in R&B, both as a producer, a songwriter, a musician, and as a fan, So about 5 years ago, I decided to start my own R&B project I called it Goldswagger, which is a play on my last name, Goldwasser, because one time I was on the phone, I was on hold with like my bank or something. And the woman, when she came back, she said, "Thank you for waiting, Mr. Goldswagger," and by mistake. And I just thought, you know what, that's gonna be the name of my R&B project. Nice. So it was great. I got together a bunch of great singers and musicians. And, you know, I wrote everything, produced everything, played all over it. And it was very gratifying to make, even though I do love reggae, it was gratifying to make R&B music that people appreciated. And it, the album went to number one on the UK soul charts. It also did pretty well in Japan. So, you know, because it's, as a music creator, you know, you have a, sometimes you have a lot to say and you need various ways to get it out there, you know? So, you know, I just felt this need to do this stuff. And it's really, you know, it's very gratifying also with any kind of music, to put out music and it gets on the radio somewhere and people these in this day and age, they can write to you and tell you how your song affected them, you know, whether it's, you know, made them feel good or maybe it made them reflect on their life, things like that. So, you know, ultimately to me, music is about connecting with people and hopefully touching people in a positive way, you know, so doing different styles of music allows me to reach more people and different people. So it's very, that's really what it's about to me.
Do you still do any type of R&B or musical projects?
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm writing and producing for myself R&B all the time. And I'm always, you know, trying to find the right artists to work with for that. I actually just co-wrote a song that's going to be on, there's a group called Southern Avenue. They're from Memphis. They were nominated for a Grammy last year. They play like Memphis funk, soul, rock. And I just wrote a song for them with Jason Mraz, and it's going to be on the next album. So, nice. Yeah, so I'm still, you know, if any R&B artist came to me and said, "Michael, I'd love for you to write and produce for me," I'd do it in a second, you know? I mean, right. It's that means a lot to me.
Well, okay, well, great. That's good to know, and I'm sure that's going to be news to a lot of us. And definitely we'll check it out. So I want to back up again one more time. Sure. Now the R&B band broke up, I guess, because you were in college and people had to go their separate ways again, like in high school. Were there anybody in either of your bands, your high school band or your college band, that you still connect with today, or anybody that kind of moved on and maybe had a flourishing career like you did?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, I love everyone I've ever played with, you know, and I'm still very, very good friends with one of my friends who was in my high school band with. And from my college band, we didn't actually break up because college was over. We lasted for quite a few years afterwards. We broke up just, I think it was like internal pressure from, we had some really big opportunities that didn't pan out. And I think it just kind of, we just kind of imploded from that, which happens sometimes, right? Being in a band isn't easy. But anyway, I'm still very good friends with the drummer from my college and post-college band, Franz Hilaire, who actually played drums on some of the earliest Easy Star recordings. And then the keyboardist from that band was also a friend of mine from back in high school, Victor Axelrod, aka Tikla, who has a very flourishing reggae career. And he was an early member of the Easy Star All-Stars, and we co-produced Dub Side of the Moon together, and we're still great friends. I talked to him, you know, a couple weeks ago. Yeah, so I'm still we're all brothers and sisters, you know.
Yeah, well, that's great. Yeah, well, that's kind of what I was hoping for, something like that. So then what made you decide to go from playing in bands to start a reggae record label?
Well,
an Easy Star, to be exact.
Yeah. Well, okay. So Easy Star Records, I founded it with three friends of mine, Eric Smith, Lem Oppenheimer, and Ramey Gerstein. And we were friends since high school. They all went to the same high school. I went to a different high school, but through mutual friends, we just were friends. And often, you know, after college, we would get together and listen to reggae often, or go see reggae shows together. And I remember one particular show was, to me, very important in the formation of Easy Star, which was, I'm sure you remember Heartbeat Records from Massachusetts. You know, they were one of the biggest labels back in the 80s and 90s. So they put on a Heartbeat Reggae tour. It was Sister Carol, The Meditations, Michael Rose, and Derek Morgan. And all four of us went to that show when it came to New York. And I kind of remember thinking about like the quality of the performances and the quality of the songs. And if we were all thinking like, why don't we, and also we were kind of bummed out about the state of reggae in the mid 90s. Not that there wasn't good stuff happening, but as a musician, coming from the world of live music and analog vibes, I was kind of sad that so much Jamaican reggae was computerized and programmed. Not that there isn't a place for that. And I certainly loved a lot of dancehall in the late 80s, early 90s. But I really wanted to hear live reggae, you know, or reggae recordings made by live musicians. And then most of the reggae we knew from the US, we just felt it was like people trying too hard to sound like Bob Marley and failing. And look, I have mad respect for anyone's making music, but what was going on in reggae in the mid 90s wasn't really appealing to me or to any of us. And we thought, you know, seeing these great artists like Sister Carol, Meditations, Michael Rose, we're like, we know there's great reggae out there. And we thought maybe we just have to do it ourselves. You know, so that's kind of how Easy Star started, of all of us just sitting around listening to reggae and thinking like, well, if we don't like what's coming out now, why don't we just do it? And because I was the only one of the four of us who was a musician and who had some experience producing, I became the producer, you know, which was great. And that led to the founding of the Easy Star All-Stars. But I'll let you ask a question before I keep rambling on.
Yeah, well, it's good to hear. And it sounds like everybody's pretty much still there, correct? Although the four other founding.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Because I've talked to every one of them in recent times. So that's good to see and good to hear. And I'm just going to interject a little bit that we, Culture Shock and Easy Star, come, now that I see it, it's even more similar than I thought it was. Mm-hmm. When I was actually looking for a name, I had three names. There was Tidal Wave, Culture Shock, and Easy Star, believe it or not. Easy Star was a contender.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and it was, I was incorporated in 96, so the idea started in 95.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think I was like about a year after you guys, but I didn't know about you till 95. I was coming back from New York and I saw a sticker on a locker at the Miami International Airport. And I go, well, there goes one name.
That's awesome. That is so funny.
And then the next.
But you know what? Like, we didn't start Easy Star. We incorporated in September 96. And I don't think we made any stickers till like 97, maybe. At best. So maybe it was 97 that you went.
Well, you know, the thing is, I incorporated and I didn't make my decision until I incorporated in March of 96. So wow. I don't know. Maybe that was just one that got leaked. I don't know.
Anyway, it's pretty amazing that the story is so parallel. Very cool.
And so what happened was I saw your guy's name and I'm like, all right, I'm down to two choices. The next week, I saw a flyer of a sound system that was from South Kendall, South Miami and Kendall called Tidal Wave. And they're actually still around. They're just a real small localized Jamaican sound down in the Southwest. And then, so I was just like, all right, well, I'm left with Culture Shock. So I went to corporate and there was a company called Culture Shock already. So what I did is that's why I spelled it the way I do. And I added music to it. Because I was more of a sound system and I was getting into producing too. And to hear your thoughts that you were disappointed in the music, that it wasn't live, was the same reason I did. you know, because
Wow.
I wanted that, you know, I was going to Jamaica and recording on 2-inch analog tapes down in Jamaica. And,
Yeah.
you know, so it's just great to hear your guy's story. It's so similar in so many ways, even more than I thought. So
yeah.
Let's move into more of Easy Star and the Easy Star All-Stars, the Easy All-Stars. That was, I'm sure, your creation since you were the musician producer. Tell us how that came about. And I know it was kind of a revolving, ever-changing lineup because people come and go and New York has so many musicians and you probably liked some people or whatever. Just tell us a story about that.
Well, the idea was, so we started the label. I started writing music, you know, making demos of what I thought our first releases would be. And then we started meeting up with artists, even auditioning people sometimes. And when it came time to record, you know, I knew some musicians that I wanted to play on this stuff. And we thought, well, I guess the band should have a name. So we figured we were thinking about branding. You know, it's important to think about branding. So we thought if we put the name of the label into the name of the band, that should be good branding for the label. So then we thought, well, you know, we're going to have a lots of different great musicians from the New York reggae scene involved. It's like an all-star cast musicians. So we came up with Easy Star All-Stars, which was kind of a blessing and a curse because so many people screw up that name. They're like, oh, the Easy Dub All-Stars, Easy Stars. And, you know, so, but anyway, that's the name, Easy Star All-Stars. It stuck. And I knew from the beginning, so I wanted to have Victor Axelrod to play a lot of the keys just because we were friends and, you know, musically very simpatico. And I wanted my friend Franz from my R&B band to play drums because I also knew he was a great drummer. And our earliest release was just the three of us. I played bass and guitar. That was Anything for Ja by Rob Simeon, who's still making great music. Each recording session, you know, our first album, Easy Star Volume 1, which came out in 1998, it was just a collection of, we just kept recording songs until we felt like we had enough songs for an album. So each session I would do, you know, I might put together different musicians for that session just based on, sometimes the artist would be like, yeah, I really want to use this drummer. Sometimes I would call someone and they wouldn't be available, so I'd get someone else, you know. So I was kind of like the only constant in the band, which is kind of the way it's been. You know, I've done many things over the years branded as Easy Star All-Stars, where it's just me and lots of different musicians. So we started as just a house band, a studio band. We, at that point, you know, we didn't realize we were going to start doing shows, but that did come relatively soon in the history.
Nice. Yeah. So, you know, so there was how many volumes of the Easy Star All-Stars?
Well, we did an Easy Star Volume 1 and Easy Star Volume 2. The first official Easy Star All-Stars show was, I think, in 1999. It was after Augustus Pablo had passed away, mm-hmm. and we did a tribute show to Augustus Pablo, which was really meaningful to me. I love Augustus Pablo. I love instrumental music and dub, although, you know, a lot of people can't get music unless there's singing, but maybe it's from my, you know, a jazz background or whatever. I think there's so much to get from instrumental music, and he was perhaps a little unsung, no pun intended, because instrumental music gets short shrift. So we did a show of all Augustus Pablo tunes, put together a nice big band with two keyboardists, horn section, two guitars, drums, bass, and percussion. And we even got Delroy Williams, who used to sing, who Augustus Pablo produced a couple of songs. He unfortunately passed away last year. We got him to come and sing a few songs with us too. And I guess maybe that made me realize that you know, the live thing could be a thing. Oh, you know what? I just messed up the history. We did a show in 1998 when we put out Easy Star Volume 1. We did a great show in New York, backing up Sister Carol, the Meditations, Sugar Minot, Rankin Joe, and then a bunch of the lesser known artists that were on Easter Volume 1, like Rob Simeon, Ruff Scott, Patrick Jr. It was just a big New York Jamaican reggae crew. So that was our first show. And then we started playing more regularly after we did the Augustus Pablo thing. And we saw the reaction. We did another Augustus Pablo tribute. Then we did a Dennis Brown tribute and a Jackie Mittoo tribute. Then we did a show backing up Sugar. It was all, well, I mean, the crux of the show was his Studio One stuff. Okay. So his albums were for Studio One. And then, of course, we played various greatest hits after that. And it was really funny because he didn't remember a lot of the lyrics to these songs that he hadn't sung, you know, since whatever, 1978 on Showcase. So I had to like mouth lyrics to him on stage. It was hysterical. We backed up Johnny Osborne. So we became more than just a studio band. It became a live thing.
Well, great. Yeah, because I think that's where most musicians want to go anyway.
Yeah, man. I mean, look, I just want to make music, whether it's live or in the studio, you know, but it's just expression, you know?
For sure. Well, Len, you know, did the tributes you did with all, you know, starting with Augustus Pablo and Dennis Brown and all those, did that help lead into kind of what you did with Pink Floyd and Radiohead and Michael Jackson? Did that stuff kind of lead to that? Is that where that stuff stems from? Or if it didn't, then where did that come from?
Yeah, there isn't really a connection, although it makes sense that you would think that, but it really isn't. What happened was, so we were cruising along, doing Easy Star. We put out a record by The Meditations, a new album by The Meditations, which I loved working on. We got some stuff from the vaults from Sugar Minot and put out a couple albums, Hidden Treasures Volume 2. We were cruising along, making music that we loved. Couldn't sell so many copies of it, you know, because that was just the state of the reggae industry. And then my partner Lem, he was a big Pink Floyd fan. He one day had the idea, I think he was listening to Dark Side of the Moon. He's like, hey, could we do a reggae version of this, you know? So we brought the idea to the rest of us, and I was skeptical at first because I didn't know the Pink Floyd album really well. I mean, I knew the big songs from it, but I don't know if I'd ever just sat down and really listened to it. But I listened, and I still remember in my bedroom studio, I made an arrangement to the first song, Breathe, and just real simple. I just programmed some drums and played bass and some piano and maybe some organ. I don't even think I put guitar in it, but I was like, wow, I guess this kind of works. And I realized the album had a lot of like, you know, two chord songs like reggae. The tempos were good for reggae for the most part. Thematically, like lyrically, there were a lot of universal messages in Pink Floyd's lyrics that, because they were coming from a British band and because Jamaica was a British colony, you know, there was like this big influence of England in Jamaica. So it kind of made sense in that way, lyrically. So we just started, you know, writing arrangements. And then I brought in Victor Axelrod, AKA Tickler, to co-produce with me because he had his own studio in his house, you know, much better than my bedroom, where we could really record, you know? And so we actually, we recorded the basic tracks to tape at another studio, and then we did most of the overdubs and mixing at Victor's studio. But yeah, we had no idea what we were getting into. You know, we just thought, let's make an album that hopefully can break down some barriers and bring more people into the reggae world, but in an authentic way, without watering down the reggae, you know, but to get the attention of people who wouldn't typically listen to reggae.
Well, it obviously did that, and it did a lot more. Still one of the more successful, especially of the modern times, for a reggae album. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that success?
Wow. Well, it was pretty amazing. I mean, you know, we finished the album. It took us, we spent 3 years recording and mixing that album because we didn't first of all, we didn't know it was going to become a thing. We just thought, yeah, it's a cool project, you know. And then, you know, I was, you know, working part time or something during the day. You know, we'd do a session and then we wouldn't do another session for weeks or sometimes even a few months, you know. So it just took a long time to finish. And because of that, because of the lack of pressure, and also because I wasn't a big Pink Floyd fan, I didn't maybe realize it was this sacred cow that people would care about so much. So because of that, I think we were able to make it right, you know, even though it was on a very low budget. And so when it was done, I remember actually Eric Smith, one of my other partners, and I, we listened to the whole thing together with the intent of trying to get it to sync up to The Wizard of Oz in some kind of way that made sense, because people always talked about listening to Dark Side of the Moon and watching Wizard of Oz together, and that somehow like it syncs up in a way where like something happens musically and then something happens in the film, right? And I'd never experienced that before, but then we're like, well, let's try to create that with Dub Side of the Moon. So, and I realized like just by like editing something by a couple seconds, I can make something line up, you know? So I remember listening to it with Eric while watching Wizard of Oz, and I remember kind of thinking like, wow, maybe we have something here. Not because of the Wizard of Oz thing, but just, I guess I felt like it was something greater than just, oh yeah, we made an album. So we took the step of hiring a PR company to push the album, which we had never done before, or maybe we had, I honestly don't even remember. And the day that I thought, that I realized, I think people really are getting this, two things. One, it was featured on NPR on this program called All Songs Considered. They played Breathe and talked about it. And when that happened, that very day, iTunes didn't even exist yet. I was watching the Amazon music charts, you know, like the rankings, what's selling the most on Amazon. I remember I was at a temp job, you know, furtively using the computer for checking Amazon when I was supposed to be working. And I kept seeing as the day went by that Dub Simon was climbing up the charts, and not the reggae charts, like the overall charts. And by the end of that afternoon, it was number three on Amazon after, I think it was like Celine Dion and the Dixie Chicks and then Dub Side of the Moon, Easy Star All-Stars, you know? So I was like, wow, I guess people are really feeling this, you know? And then we did our first mini US tour. We just did a few shows. I know we did New York, we did Charlottesville, Virginia, and I feel like there must've been another couple shows, and the crowds were going wild. People who wouldn't normally come to a reggae show somehow maybe found out about this. And I remember playing this club in Charlottesville, Virginia. It wasn't huge. I think the capacity was like 450 people, but every song we played from Dub Side of the Moon, we played the whole album straight through. People were jumping up and down so much that like the floors were just shaking. Like I was actually thinking, is this club gonna fall apart? You know? So, there was a response, and then we did an extended U.S. tour, and then there was international interest. And now in the end, we've played, I don't know, 45 different countries and 6 different continents, played the Glastonbury Festival in England, played lots of amazing shows, and met a lot of amazing people, shared the stage with so many of our idols, artists that we admire, you know, so it's really been a blessing.
Nice.